Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project research director and soccer parent extraordinaire Joshua Blank.
That's me. Yep. Shoe fit. Shoes fit. Cleats fit.
Yep. What are soccer shoes? There must be a special soccer shoe. Are they like cleats? They're not cleats, though.
Yeah,
are they
cleats? Yeah. You can call them boots. If you want to call them boots, that's a little bit more European.
You wear your boots on the pitch.
Yeah, on the pitch. That's right.
All right. I've watched some British
TV.
And
then you see what the match score is.
And, you know, every 4 years I remember the pitch.
I had a roommate in college who would just try to, like, you know, put people on by kind of walking into an American football game and go, "Hey, guys, what's the score of the match?"
Yeah.
And they just be like, "Get out. Get out, Dave."
Yeah, that's enough. Enough. So, on the menu today, the April UT Texas Politics Project
Woo,
poll.
Woo! April.
Released yesterday morning at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu, and as we're going through some of the results today, if you'd like to follow along at home and you're on an appropriate device, you could, if you log on to the site at that URL, you'll see a link on the front page and all kinds of highlights on the front page, part of the usual rollout. So, you know, we often talk about the overall vibe or feeling of a poll.
Yeah.
And honestly, to me, for a lot of the prep and the writing up of this, and this might have been context. I don't know. I mean, of course, I think context always matters. So it'd be consistent for me to say part of this was context. But certainly, as we were putting this together and then making sense of it and writing it up, it felt like a little bit of a slog to me and a bit like I was constantly trying to find the through lines or trying to look for the drama, et cetera, et cetera. But as we got through that part of it and I got to think about it a little bit more, you know, go through that process, which is always helpful. I mean, I think this is not unusual. It just felt a little more this time to me, like that I couldn't, it felt a little, another poll, but I've come to feel like this poll does align with the moment in a lot of different dimensions pretty well.
Yeah, and I mean, I just want to say, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that because I've been thinking about this a lot recently and just various conversations I'm having with people. And, you know, the word of 2026 still seems to be vibes, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And we're still kind of using that. And I was thinking about, you know, why is that the case in some sense? And I think one thing that I was talking to somebody, I can't remember what the reason for this conversation was. And it does speak to this, which is like, you know, this is like a bit of an anachronism, but, you know, we talk about a lot about, you know, what used to be in the sense of like there used to be network television. There used to be like a common narrative. And we also talk a lot here about the fragmentation of the information environment, the attention economy, and just, you know, honestly, like in some ways it's easier to reach people, but they're just so much more divided into different, you know, areas and verticals and so on.
And they're being reached by so many more different people.
Yeah. Right. And so I do feel like that, you know, there's a validity to some extent as someone in a study public opinion thinking about this vibe question and the muddiness of it, because it's not as though there's a clear through line all the time, because it just doesn't really feel like there is.
Right.
And you start to look at the data and you say, yeah, there's a through line over here and it kind of lines up with some people, you know, there's another through line over here, but also all the stuff is going on at the same time. And so it's hard to, I mean, we always say at a certain point you're like, hey, this is all pushing in a similar direction. So it's hard to pull out something and say, well, this is the thing.
Yeah,
it's the war,
I think that's right.
You know, the prices. And then you are stuck with this kind of like, yeah, the vibes. Yeah. But it's something I've been thinking about a lot because it is harder to characterize.
Yeah, and I use the term loosely. I mean, I think there are, and sometimes we're very conscious about that. They're identifiable themes.
Yeah, for sure.
And there was a bit less of that this time.
No, but you're right. I mean, we just, you know, and some of this is just, you know, the nature of the job and, you know, timing and whatever. There were a lot of things in this poll that were specifically speaking to the moment. I mean, and just in the way that the timing of the poll went out and sort of the things that we normally look at, plus the things we chose to add into this. It just, there's a lot we could talk about. So what are we going to start with, I guess?
Well, in events.
Yeah, in events,
as sometimes happen.
Right.
Sharpen the significance of some of the results that weren't quite necessarily as sharp when we went in the field.
Right.
Obviously, the Iran war and the economy were going to be things, but the way that the Senate races unfolded, and then yesterday when we released, the day we released the poll was a very newsy day.
Yeah.
We had the Secretary of Defense and folks from the Pentagon testifying in a pretty heated congressional hearing. We had the Voting Rights Act decision by the Supreme Court, movement on the front of the Federal Reserve, that kind of unclogging the Federal Reserve held, Open Market Committee held interest rates steady yesterday. There was a lot going on yesterday, too.
Even before you get
I was doing
stuff.
Media hits yesterday and talking to people, of the, I don't know, four or five I did, most everybody led with something different, even though the headlines were in the morning blasts and the first wave of responses on social media and the newsletters all focused on the hypothetical head-to-heads we did in the Senate race. So we're going to come to that in the end. So let's lead the way we did in the rollout post that you'll see at our website with the economy and the war, which were the hooks going in.
Right.
And then we'll dig into some details in the Senate race, and then we'll come back to more of it probably next week in the podcast, assuming everything goes to plan and we're here for a podcast next week.
Right.
So let's start with the economy. I've been describing the rise in concern about gas prices.
Yeah.
And the uptick in concerns about the economy as probably the least surprising results in the poll.
Yeah.
It's a standard question. People say, what are you most surprised by? Or sometimes we have Darren on or you, and I'll say, okay, what stood out to you? We knew this was going to be, it was pretty predictable that with the objective rise in gas prices being severe and rapid, that we were going to see that.
Yeah, and then I think the question becomes, you know, compared to what? And also, the other piece of this, too, is in the environment we're in sometimes, you know, the surprise sometimes is when stuff doesn't move the way you expect it's going to. So, I mean, that's just something to sort of throw out there. Overall, just to mention, we were in the field from April 10th to the 20th. We had a survey of 1,200 self-identified registered voters for the full sample. That creates a margin of sampling error of plus or minus 2.83 percentage points. All of this information is available.
3.35 adjusted for weighting.
For weighting, yes. And
all more attention to that this time for some reason.
Yeah, for some reason. All this information is available on our website, the methods, the data set, top lines, cross tabs, everything. So you can, you know, if you want to dig in, please do, in fact. Overall, like looking at this gas price, we regularly ask a battery of about economic concerns, specific economic concerns, and the extent to which, you know, people are anywhere from very concerned to not at all concerned about these different issues. And we're tracking to see what is the nature of concern we see in the economy or its absence. Obviously, prices, you know, for consumer goods have remained high in terms of people's concerns, 65%. The price of gasoline and energy really jumped up in this poll, as you mentioned, right? So in February, 38% of Texans were very concerned about the price of energy and gasoline. That actually put it not at the bottom, but kind of near the bottom of overall economic concerns.
Yeah, prior. Yeah.
Prior, in February. And then you jump ahead. Now it's 61%. So again, that's a pretty huge jump. That's 23 points over the course of a few months, not to be, you know, again, not surprising under the circumstances. But, you know, super impactful. Like, we talk about these things. We talk about the issue of salience a lot. And we say, you know, there's a reason that grocery prices being high is a really big political concern to people, because outside of these sort of ideological issues and other things, people buy groceries. Same thing with gas. People fill up their tanks, you know, every week, usually in a place like Texas, maybe more so. And so this is something that really makes people feel negative economic consequences in a way that transcends rhetoric or kind of any other things about, you know, interest rates and tariff policy and all that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, but like, what are you paying for gas this week because you paid last week? You know, overall, I think it's important to note here that Democratic and independent concern is higher than Republican concern, but it's kind of also notable that it has been in the last, over the
right.
course of the last, you know, year anyway, towards gas prices.
And across the board, I don't think I'm wrong about this. All these concern items, all of the economic readings, Republicans have been more positive than Democrats.
That's right. And I mean, I think
less negative.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and I think you have to accept that, you know, partisanship plays some role in this. You know, if you want to, and you can take that two different ways, but I want to caveat it, right? One, you can say Democrats are more negative because there's a Republican in the White House and the economy's attached to them. You could say Republicans are more positive for the vice versa. Where we can kind of like cut through that a little bit is look at independents.
Right.
And Democrats look a lot more like independents than Republicans do. Or independents look a lot more like Democrats, I should say, than the other way around. I said it that way meaningfully, but it's confusing. But yeah, the Democrats and the independents look a lot more similar in their attitudes than Republicans, who are less concerned. But nonetheless, the share of Republicans who are very concerned about the price of gasoline and energy was up from 28% in February to 46%. In April. So, I mean, they are feeling the pinch as well, even setting all these
caveats
aside.
And the flip side of that, for context, I think, was that it went from, as you said, the lower tier of intense, very, you know, quote unquote, very concerned items.
Yeah.
To the top four.
Yeah.
Right. Along with, you know, the other three that have dominated these readings
for
months. Even, you know, almost measurable in years now, a couple of years. And that is price of food and consumer goods, cost of health care, which we talked a lot about after the last poll, which I think receded slightly by about 3 points, but still in the top three.
Right.
And then price of gasoline and energy inserted itself above the cost of housing, which at 53% is about where it's been, a little bit on the low end of the band, in which it's fluctuated for about the last year.
Right. And the sum total of all of this is, in this poll, a majority of Texans, 55%, said the economy, the national economy, is worse than it is last year. Only 27%, so just barely more than one in four, say that the economy is doing better compared to last year. This is a pretty, I would say, I don't want to say a sharp reversal, but it's definitely a negative turn from last month, which wasn't great. I mean, we've been kind of talking about this, which is that up until the engagement with Iran, actually, you know, the economic attitudes had been thawing a little bit.
Incrementally better.
Yeah, now I say, not good.
Right. And this is where going to the website and looking is really helpful.
Yeah.
If we were doing this in a class or something, we now go to the slide.
Yeah.
That shows the gap, the numbers. It's very clear that for two polls, we had seen decreases in the number said the economy was worse, and increases in the share that said it was better. Yeah. Not a lot.
Yeah.
But slight improvements, but then it reversed. And it's real clear in the line graph of the trend data.
Yeah, exactly. So back in, you know, October of last year, you know, it was 27 better, 53 worse, and then it started to get a little better, 34 better, 49 worse, a little bit better, 36 better, 46 worse, and now we're back to 27-55 better, worse. And that basically looks, that 55% saying the national economy is worse off, kind of, it hasn't been that bad since about October of 2023. So in terms of the overall scope of the intensity. So, you know, but I think part of the reason that's kind of useful to look in this data, even if it's not, I mean, to your point, even if it's not surprising, this gives us a comprehensive look at what this is. And part of this is to remind people that as much as gas prices become front and center for voters, one of the things you have to understand is that it's in an overall environment in which they've been consistently expressing concerns about prices. They've been consistently expressing, you know, the healthcare concerns. They've been consistently expressing the concerns about the price of housing. And so this actually just adds another piece onto, you know, again, a set of attitudes that are already kind of there.
And there's an interesting, just a kind of a footnote. There's an interesting match between housing being a major concern, more than 50% consistently for the last couple of years, but below the others, as we look at, speaking of the news, macroeconomic data that was circulating this year showing decreases in sales prices of homes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and homes, you know, basically the housing market cooling, and in particular in Texas and in particular in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is, we're getting into the speculation. We'll move past this in a second. But this is where it's really interesting, where you sort of realize that these things in isolation can provide different stories. Because you're right. I mean, the sense that if you look, I mean, Austin's an interesting, I mean, we're in Texas. We're talking about Texas. But like Austin.
And Austin is an extreme example. It's near the top of the list nationally of declines in home values over the last year.
And a huge part of that, especially around rent prices and inside home prices, has been the fact that there's been a ton of building here spurred on by policy, both actually at the local and the state level. So it's been a combined effort. You know, so in some ways, I just want to say, if you listen to this from Madison, it's like, oh, you know, Austin, haha, you know, nobody wants it. It's like, well, no, actually, we've been building a ton here to meet the
demand.
It's
a policy outcome.
It is a policy outcome, which is, you know, whatever, funny. Yeah. But the other piece to this is to say that, yeah, you know, I think the challenge in all this in isolation is, yeah, okay, rents might be coming down. Maybe home prices are going down, but home prices are going down amidst significantly higher interest rates. Rents may be going down, but that's also in the face of higher gas prices, higher grocery prices, and potentially stagnant incomes. And so even though the house, you know, the housing prices may not objectively be getting higher at the same rate as other things, it doesn't mean that it's not a higher share of people's incomes when you think about these other necessities that are floating right. around, including healthcare, actually.
So, I was saying healthcare is a big part of that. Pretty large yeah. in there.
No, yeah. that's right.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about attitudes in the war in Iran. And I want to start, before we even get into the numbers, yeah. which, again, not amazingly surprising.
Well,
we're,
yeah.
we're pretty negative, but with a lot of partisan structure, though, with an asterisk on that, that we'll get yeah. into. But I do want to talk a little bit about the linkage between the Iran attitudes and the economic attitudes. Because it was interesting in talking to folks
mm-hmm.
In the last 24 hours about the degree to which the two were reflexively linked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes sense to say that in tough economic times, or a time when the war seems to be having a direct impact on prices, particularly fuel prices,
yeah.
that would inform people's attitudes toward the war.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's plausible.
But I think there's a lot of other things going on too, right?
Yeah.
And I just, that kind of come out in these yeah. numbers. But I want to just put that on the table because well, I, on one hand, it's you want to say, well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's
on
funny.
The other hand, there, you know, this has been a long brewing kind of public opinion issue in terms of attitudes towards U.S. military ventures overseas, U.S. connections overseas,
yeah.
and all that is happening too.
Yeah.
The economy stuff is probably more immediate, but I don't even really have a big point to make about
no.
this other than to say that connection's there, but I don't wonder if I sometimes felt myself compelled to say a little bit of a yeah, but.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those like deceptively, you know, seemingly simple questions that you get, that one gets asked in our position. And then you start to, and you know, I mean, you'd be, I mean, I'm just thinking like, if I were in your position, I'd be sitting there and I'd probably pause for a second and go, well, I can see why that's probably true. But it's also like, if you start to unpack, I mean, one of the things just to throw, and again, this is a major point here, but just to throw into this kind of the mix of this is I think the whole point, maybe the major point is this, is that it's very tempting right now to sort of draw that straight line and say,
right.
okay, you know, the war in Iran is generally being received negatively. The increase in gas prices is almost certainly, you know, being felt and received negatively, you know, and so therefore there's a linkage here that people are making this a connection. And I think, yeah, plausibly, the problem is there's a couple things. I mean, one, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, the power of how powerful motivated reasoning is here, right? And part of that is the partisanship angle. You know, we've known for a long time that Republicans have really been moving in an anti-interventionist, even sort of pro-isolationist direction in the politics, especially publicly, that this, and a lot of people pointed out, that this really kind of flies in the face of, but then, you know, motivated reason is really strong. And when we look at that data, we do see movement there in the last month, just in the face of this conflict. So I think there's that. To your point also, I'd say, you know, there's another element here, which is, you know, in political science, we talk about something called like the rally around the flag effect, the idea that once we're in a foreign conflict, there tends to be, you know, some kind of wellspring of support that emerges.
Right. Although there's been some writing in the policy yeah. community recently and in academics about, I mean, there was an article, you know, bad academic, I don't
yeah.
remember who wrote it or even where I saw it, but that the title was, is the rally around the effect,
is
the rally around the flag effect still happening, or is it, how much has it been weakened, et cetera?
And I only raise that just to say, like, you know, there's a different argument where you say, like, hey,
right.
maybe, you know, maybe something else happens here. And just
sure.
to say, with the assumption. And so that's all just to sort of throw that out there, that, you know, there's a lot going on here. I mean, to your point, you know, because it's Iran and not somewhere else, you know,
yes.
that matters. We know there are very negative attitudes towards Iran. We know that in Texas there are very negative attitudes towards groups that can be generally aligned with terrorists. You know, I mean, very easily that's going on here. The intervention isolation thing, the fact that we are now committed to this. Yeah, it's complicated, right? Like, so
right.
We, I
and
think
we talked about this a few weeks ago when the war broke out. We looked at attitude towards Iran,
right.
partisan where there's not much in the way of partisan
right.
patterns. Attitudes towards Israel,
right.
where there is a lot of partisan structure.
Right.
The movement in this abstract measure of should the U.S. be staying at home or should we remain more, or should we be more engaged, et cetera.
Right.
There's a lot going on there. I think one of the things I said to a couple people that asked me about this was, you know, it's plausible. We did not directly ask people.
Yeah.
What.
Yeah.
You know, what was bothering them about this, or what they, you know, in other words, yeah. Well, what their response and that to was what actually, was at stake.
And that was somewhat of a concerted decision. I mean, because partially, you know, at that point, we did consider the fact that a lot of the discussion going on when we were writing this was about, you know, whether or not the administration had clearly explained the goals.
Right.
And generally knew from public opinion that, that most people had indicated that they had not been presented with a clear rationale for the conflict. So in some sense, then asking them which rationale they choose is creating opinions.
Yeah, and we
and
considered
not
questions
it.
Like that have been in some national polls.
Yeah.
I mean,
so anyway, overall, I mean, just to sort of put, let's put
but
some.
But didn't include them.
Yeah, let's put some data on this real quick,
yeah,
you know, and then we can move on from this. But overall, when we asked Texans, you know, do you approve or, first of all, I should just actually say, in the news battery, I mean, this is at the top of the list. 76% of Texans said they'd heard a lot about this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is dominating
top of the battery,
know, people's
yeah.
attention. Yeah.
Of the 12 or six or eight items we asked, or eight or 10.
Yeah. Political stories, right? Overall, 49% of Texans, a plurality, disapprove of the military action against Iran. 37% approve. When we look at by party, you know, not surprisingly, we see 84% of Democrats and 72% of independents disapproving of the military engagement. Among Republicans, 69% approve, 16% disapprove. Now, where this gets really interesting.
All right, now, before we go too far, let's stop there for a sec, because I think we want to talk about that Republican number a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of set up
Please.
To talk about it, so
yeah,
let's flag it. That 69 is pretty high.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about a rally around the flag effect, it's for a policy being identified with same party president in power, I would argue not amazingly high.
Yeah.
Now, people can talk about that differently. And
yeah.
I don't want to be subject, or, you know, I know this is subject to the, you know, naysaying critics of the president thing or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think there's a good argument to be made that if you've got 69% of, you know, in favor,
yeah,
16% outright opposed, and then the rest otherwise on the fence, that's interesting. You know, 15% or so, give
yeah.
or take, 15-16%. It's an interesting thing to flag. One could say, as I'm implying here, that it's a little bit low,
mm-hmm.
but you could also say that, given a lot of the president's critics and the people in both inside the party and outside the party in the chattering classes
mm-hmm.
who were saying, well, Donald Trump has alienated his supporters and violated his campaign promises, and he's going to pay, not paying very much, as the, at least at this point in time, April 10th to the 20th.
Yeah.
You know, we saw other national data that we used in teaching our class from YouGov early on that's strongly indicated that at least as of in the first week or two after the war, that support could be dropped the longer people expected it to last.
Yeah.
So all of that has to go into this. But I did find that 69 an interesting, maybe to go back to being almost a sloggy number, probably one of those numbers I looked at and went, oh, yeah, well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, you're walking, you know, the fine line that's sort of necessary to walk here, right? Which is to both acknowledge the fact that, look, you know, it's got majority Republican support. It's got, I mean, you could say nearly overwhelmingly Republican majority support, but that's kind of where this kind of gets into
yeah.
this sort of weird space.
I guess I would say this, I'm not overwhelmed by it.
No, and that's
but it's
I said,
high,
I said,
but I don't want to downplay the fact that it's almost 70%. I mean, you know, 70% between friends, pretty good.
What's why I say this is why this is hard to characterize, because when I say like, well, it's like nearly overwhelming support, but also there's this like, and this is why I use another like weirdo term of art that I use, like, but there's a significant minority who are expressing opposition, you know,
or ambivalence.
And also, I mean, there's another piece to this, right? Right. I mean, you already mentioned some of the other data, you know, we've seen nationally about, you know, support tends to generally decline as the length of the engagement increases. But another question we asked was about support for the deployment of U.S. ground troops.
Right.
Now here, you know, once again, what we generally find across the board, and this includes Republicans, is significantly less support once we talk about committing ground troops.
Right.
So again, overall approval of military action was 37 approve, 49 disapprove. Deployment of U.S. ground troops, 30 approve, 60 disapprove. So we go, disapproval goes up to clear majority and up 11 points. Obviously, you know, I don't need to go.
Some of the people that are on the fence in the first question get off the fence.
Yeah, on this
when you say, how about ground troops?
Right. And so when you look at, now, obviously, I don't even worry about the numbers here. Democrats overwhelmingly opposed, independents overwhelmingly opposed. Both go up in their opposition. Democrats a little, independents a little bit more. Republicans, on the other hand, remember, 69% approve of the military action, but 55% approve of deployment of ground troops. That's a 14-point drop. 16% disapprove of the military action. 35% oppose the deployment of ground troops. That's a 19-point increase. When we said, you know, do you approve or disapprove of the military action, 45% of Republicans strongly approved of the military action. Deployment of ground troops, again, it's still a majority of Republicans, important, 23% strongly approve, 32% are support, you know, the deployment, right. 32% somewhat support the deployment.
Yeah, the intensity numbers are at an interesting dimension. Yeah.
And so that's to say, I mean, just overall, as we point out, as the length of the conflict increases, as our potential actual footprint in the conflict increases, I mean, I think to your point, yeah, that's high level of support, but, you know, in some sense, do we think that's going to expand or contract as time goes on? And all indication is that it's likely to contract. Yeah.
Yeah, that both time and level of commitment, and one of the big themes yesterday that we didn't ask about, expense in economic times, are going to bear on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so...
And we could talk more about this, just to say there's foreign policy trends for Trump, and there's a bunch of stuff in here that actually other intersections of both of these.
Because Trump's approval on foreign policy went down pretty significantly.
Yeah, pretty significantly. Right. So there's other ways to look at this, but just to...
And I think I suspect that when we come back next week, we'll talk a little more about the environment in Texas, but we'll probably also dig into those Trump numbers in the context of what is the election environment looking like now? What direction does it seem to be going?
Right, I think that's right. Okay.
But for now, let's go to this U.S. Senate race and what we did with this. And in a lot of ways, when we included these head-to-heads, it was one of those instances where I felt like, yeah, we got to do this. Do I really want the headache? But yeah, we did it.
Yeah.
So let's like start with the top lines and let's look at what we got.
Yeah. So what we did was we gave all of our respondents, two.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's also just, you know, we should also say that we did not do the runoff.
Yeah.
For all the reasons about sampling that we talked about in the primaries that are a magnitude more in play when it comes to a runoff.
Yeah, and I think one other thing I just want to say about that, because there will be runoff polling coming out. It'll be interesting. We'll all look at it. Having said that, I think everybody here who listens to this podcast, you got to be really skeptical. I mean, one, as we've always said, that's a really tiny population. It's going to be really hard to sample. Also, this is a weird runoff, right? I mean, if you think about how much money is being spent by the parties in this runoff, this does not look like historical runoffs. And so I think anybody who sort of comes at, I'll just say this, I would be skeptical of anybody who presents to you a picture of the Republican runoff electorate with too much certainty about it.
And just to touch lightly on the technical reasoning, both for that and for our decision not to poll, is like that is a poll unto itself.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to draw a sample per the, you know, allowing for the difficulties you're talking about of likely voters in the runoff. And I'm not saying that, it's not impossible to plausibly do that.
Yeah.
But it's a completely different exercise than what we were doing in the poll, and there was no point in trying to do that within the overall sample that we were using.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So, to the top lines.
So overall, you know, so we're looking at hypothetical head-to-head matchups here, and we looked at, you know, Cornyn versus Tallarico with an option for someone else and haven't thought about it enough to have an opinion because ultimately this is very early, and we know from the news battery that even though more attention is going into this race, it's still not a top story, even politically.
Right.
Okay. And then also, obviously, Paxson versus Tallarico. So at the top line level, Tallarico led in both ballots. He was 40-33 against Cornyn, so +7. 42-34 against Paxson, +8. But notably, really notably, in both of those ballots, about 1 in 5 voters, 19%, said they hadn't thought it about enough to have an opinion. In the case of the Cornyn ballot, 7% said someone else. In the case of the Paxson ballot, 5% said someone else. Now, when we look into those a little bit more, I think, look, obviously the news that comes out of that immediately is, oh, Tallarico's up. Oh, you know.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're not on social media much anymore, but, you know, the eruption of narcissistic.
Yeah.
You know, self.
There's a lot of stuff that's going to happen in response to that. So let's talk about it real quick.
Performative posting on this.
So you know.
Largely uninformed. It was pretty good.
Yeah. That's why you're not selling me to get back in there.
That's right.
So the first thing to note here is, you know, if we look at the partisanship, you know, Democrats are largely, if they know who Tallarico is, they're voting for him. I mean, it pretty much is what it largely looks like when we look at all of his numbers. 80% of Democrats said they're going to be voting for Tallarico against Cornyn. 82% statistically indistinguishable said they'd be voting for him against Paxton. Now, the key here, and this is, you know, the reflection of the current moment we're in, is that that's not what the Republican side of this looks like right now, right?
Right.
these two incumbents are in a bitter fight. They've been spending a lot of money against each other. This is ongoing battle. So what do we see?
And it emerged from a lot of, you know, even prior to the, it emerged from a lot of strong currents within the Republican Party about both of these candidates and what they've come to represent to particularly Republican opinion leaders, but,
right,
but apparently Republican voters too, right?
Yeah. And so what we find is that, you know, when we look at John Cornyn's support among Republicans, so what do Republicans say they're going to do? 60% of Republicans say they're going to support John Cornyn. 21% say, you know, I haven't thought about it yet. 1 in 10 say Tyler Rico, and another 1 in 10 say someone else.
Right. In the context of that head to head.
In the context of that head to head. Now, against Paxton, 63% of Republicans say they will be supporting Ken Paxton, which is statistically indistinguishable from the share who say they'll be supporting Cornyn. 11% say they'll be supporting Tyler Rico. Again, the same. 20%, again, the same statistically say they haven't thought about it, have an opinion. So that's like, I mean, when you say like, hey, why is Tyler Rico up 8 points? Why is he up 7 points? Well, a big part of that explanation is the fact that Republicans are still in a battle amongst themselves. And not all Republicans, have, as we could say, have come home because the party hasn't settled this fight yet.
Right. And I think you can't, I mean, you could emphasize it too much theoretically, but it's hard to overemphasize the degree, how important that is. And specifically, we were talking about context earlier.
Yeah.
The degree to which, yes, we did this poll in April between a March primary that didn't yield a clear result and a May runoff. This is right in the middle, in the teeth of what has been, by any fair account, a vicious, personal, and for this kind of race, fairly high-profile primary runoff race.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the question then becomes, what happens after this? I mean, that's really, I think, what everybody is trying to sort of, I mean, us too, we're trying to sort of figure out is, you know, how deep are the animosities? You know, how long does it take the wounds to heal? All that kind of stuff. So that's,
right. You mentioned the come home thing. And just to frame this, I mean, the overall question here, and I think I mentioned this last week in reference. I mean, I did an event that was kind of Republican conservative oriented a couple weeks ago at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And a clear underlying theme of the discussion that I felt people were, it was very present, and yet people, there was a little bit of an elephant in the room, shall we say, factor to the fact that, to the discussion and the prevailing sense that got to make sure that Republicans turn out.
Right.
And so you talked about they have to do, so there are two tasks here in the aftermath of this, the resolution of this that we were curious about in the data runs that you did here, which is, will Republicans be able to come home to the party and reunite and in a way that reduces the attrition so that, again, Republicans come home, but they don't stay home in the fall?
Well, and I want to link this to the last point you were making about the war and the you know, and Republican attitudes towards the war, where when you look at that, you say, hey, 69%, you know, support, setting aside the troop deployment, you know, that's almost pretty good. But when you're talking about, you know, again, what's likely to be another mobilization election, you know, 60 to 70% is not really good enough of your base.
Right.
And so that's sort of the question. And the question becomes, okay, let's break this down. One of the things we can do by having these two trial ballots is we can define kind of the universe a little bit more clearly and usefully to answer some of these questions about what happens
next. We should emphasize the cell numbers are small.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the pattern that we're going to talk about is fairly consistent even among data that we have to be a little careful. Yeah, we have to be careful.
Yeah, we have to be careful about it. So what you can do is you can break those trial ballots down and you say, okay, what share, and what we're going to do is we're looking at Republican voters. We're looking at Republican registered voters in Texas. So these are the registered voters, the people who identify with the Republican Party, because that's ultimately what we're going to look at for, there's complexities, you know, email me, we can talk more about it. But anyway, so we look at Republicans. Overall, 50% of Republicans are downright, you know, top of the ticket supporters. We could just say they're going to vote for Paxton. They're going to vote for Cornyn. We put those two ballots.
In this context, we'll call them Republican supporters.
Yeah, they're going to vote for the Republican candidate. They've made that clear. Now, 10% of the voters said they will vote for Cornyn, but they won't be voting for Paxton. They've chosen either someone else, Tyler Rico, haven't thought about it, right? But they can't.
Based on the, you know, the
data, the two
the responses ballots. In these two ballots.
Right. So on the Cornyn ballot, they said they vote for Cornyn. On the Paxton ballot, they said not Paxton, something else. The Paxton supporters were Paxton only. They voted for Paxton on his ballot, but they did not extend that support to Cornyn on his ballot. Overall, about 10% of Republicans are Cornyn but not Paxton supporters, and about 13% of Republicans are Paxton but not Cornyn supporters. So pretty symmetrical overall, actually.
And again, allowing for the small cell numbers, those numbers are pretty close.
Yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't want to make too much of this, but I think it is a little, like a data point with an asterisk that the Paxton number is higher than the Cornyn number.
Yeah.
And again,
but having said
that, pretty statistically difficult to distinguish, but it's still higher.
Yeah, and I think what it is, I mean, well, what you'll see is that as we go through this data, I mean, look, we'll get to this to put it up front. I mean, look, there's a sense of looking at this data that Paxton is probably a little bit more, a little bit more centrally aligned with the Republican Party, maybe, in the Republican electorate.
As we find it today.
As we find it today.
Right.
So, I mean, what does this mean? It means that, you know, just to put it in another way, I just want to make this clear, 76% of Paxton supporters say that they're going to be voting for John Cornyn. 78% of Cornyn supporters say that they're going to be voting for Ken Paxton. So real quick, the vast majority in both cases already indicated that they would support the other person. So again, right. This is about margins. Again, we're talking about like a lot of this stuff. Overall, the Republicans, the strong Republicans who'd vote for both, honestly, they look more like strong Republicans, which I think is kind of interesting. I mean, there's all this focus on
the strong Republicans are the Republican supporters.
Yeah, and they're
at the top of the ticket.
And it's actually kind of interesting because we do talk about, you know, degree of partisanship, you know, ideological stuff and how, you know, that sort of shapes things. But it is interesting to note that the core Republicans, the base is the base. Whereas there's a little bit more, I would say, both partisan and ideological heterogeneity amongst the Paxton and Cornyn only supporters.
Right.
I think I'm going to put it that way, given the data, right? I think that just to say that, you know, I mean, in general, we see that, you know, the Republican supporters are the stronger Republicans. They tend to more uniformly identify as conservatives, and that's across the board. But I will say, when it comes to ideology, the Paxton supporters do look a little bit more like the overall Republican supporters.
As we think,
than Cornyn.
At a time that the party has become more conservative.
Right, exactly. So, where does this take us? So then the next thing we can do is we can look at these groups and we can look at their views of the other candidates specifically and separately from the trial ballot, right? So we have a couple different ways we can do this. I think here we'll just focus on the fave-unfave numbers.
Right. We have fave-unfave and job approval, but they're not very different.
Yeah, and I think just for the sake of this, because we also have Tallarico that we can bring to the discussion, we can stick with fave-unfave. All right, so this is I'm going to try to do this. If I mess up, I'm sorry. There's a lot of numbers to look at, okay? So for example, let's just make some comparisons. Really what this comes down to in some ways, I think it's more about the issue of negativity towards some of these candidates than anything else. But we'll talk about it, and then you react, I guess, is how I'll do this. So if we look at views of Cornyn among Cornyn-only supporters, overall we see 76% of the Cornyn-only voters have a positive view of Cornyn. Not surprising. Paxton voters almost look exactly the same in their views towards Paxton. 75% of Paxton-only voters have a favorable view towards Paxton. They look almost indistinguishable. What's notable is the Paxton-only voters, 50% have an unfavorable view of Cornyn. Among the Cornyn-only voters, 46% have an unfavorable view of Paxton, but what's notable here is the intensity. The very unfavorable views among the Paxton-only voters is 41% of the 50. I mean, that's most of it, right? Whereas for
41% of the Paxton voters have a very unfavorable view of Cornyn.
Right, perfect, please. Whereas among the Cornyn-only voters, only 29% have a very unfavorable view of Paxton. Now, when we look at the strong, like the reps, the people who are going to support the Republican candidate no matter what, 64% held a favorable view of Cornyn, 74% held a favorable view of Paxton. And this is where I think it's kind of important. 22% of those Republican voters had an unfavorable view of Cornyn compared to 10 had an unfavorable view of Paxton. And so that speaks to the whole thing that we've kind of been talking about a lot, which is to say, you know, yeah, I think, you know, and this has been kind of the notion all along, which is Paxton probably represents the current Republican Party just a little bit better.
And certainly the universe of primary voters. And then to speculate about going on to and that's why this makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly going on to the even narrower end of the funnel, which is going to be the runoff electorate.
Well, and this is the thing that's sort of like, and this kind of even goes back to why not poll the runoff. And I'll say because the margins are so tiny amongst a tiny, tiny subset of a population. So when we look at all Republicans, for example, right? And this is what we've talked about over and over again. But if we look at all Republicans, 50% of Republicans have a favorable view of Cornyn. 57% have a favorable view of Paxton. 23% have an unfavorable view of Cornyn. 18% have an unfavorable view of Paxton. Those are pretty small margins, but they're consistent. They're consistent no matter where we look. They've been consistent over time. And I think that's sort of been kind of the big challenge. And the intensity is the other, you know, well, I'll say, well, let's just stop there for a second. Which is to say, that's been the challenge for Korn, and that's why Paxson is run. And it's still sitting there, but it's also the sort of thing where when it comes down to like an electorate showing up, I'm not saying that it means that this race is going to be like super, you know, close. Yeah, or either close or one-sided when all is done, because yeah. I just don't think we know. But the point is to say that, you know, the margins that sort of separate them are pretty small, but they're overwhelmingly consistent. Before jumping sort of to the broader electorate, do you want to say anything about that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say a couple of things. I'm sitting here scribbling
that
might
even
be
getting
picked
stop.
Up on the mic. Yeah. But, you know, one, interesting how off elite views are on this.
Yeah.
Insider views.
Yeah.
I mean, I think... I don't want to paint with too broad a brush.
Yeah.
But there's a certain amount of disbelief in the political community and the, you know, 1 mile radius of where we're sitting at UT here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about Republican and conservative elites, how much they just really have trouble grappling with the fact that Paxson would actually be competitive, let alone beat Cornyn.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a fair characterization. People are adjusting to the reality, but certainly that's been the narrative of, oh, you know, certainly Paxson can't beat Cornyn. And if you're one of the people that said all along, oh, you're just not in touch with the Republican Party, I'm not saying this was universal.
Yeah.
But the other part of that, too, is that, and you walked right up to this and you kind of said it indirectly, but another way in which the conventional wisdom and the elites judgment should be questioned is that in terms of Republican mobilization, and we're going to look at the rest of the electorate right now, but in terms of Republicans worrying about being able to mobilize turnout in the fall, Paxson may be a stronger candidate than people have thought in terms of Republican turnout in the general election.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, this isn't definitive on that, but the way that data looked to me suggests that if you're thinking, well, if we nominate Paxson, Republicans are just going to stay home. Republicans may stay home for other reasons. And Paxson, if he runs and, you know, and Democrats underperform, even if, or Republicans underperform, even if Paxson wins, this will be part of the discussion, I'm sure. But these numbers indicate that you can worry too much about that, I think,
you know,
or overestimate it.
Well, it goes back to one of these things where, you know, it's kind of like, you know, is this a checkers problem or a chess problem? And this is a chess problem, because when you look at the overall electorate, I think, you know, you're right, which is to say, if Republicans are worried about mobilization and mobilizing their base, Ken Paxson might be a better mobilizing force in the role that he's playing in this election cycle. The flip side of that is when we look at the broader electorate, while views of Cornyn and Paxson aren't significantly different between Democrats and independents, right?
So
among Democrats and independents, among Democrats and independents respectively, the intensity of those views and the negativity of those intense views are stronger around Paxson because of all the reasons we can imagine based on the news in the last few years. So, for example, you know, among Democrats, 50% have a very unfavorable view of Cornyn, but 62% have a very unfavorable view of Paxson. Among independents, 28% have a very unfavorable view of Cornyn, 38% have a very unfavorable view of Paxson. And so that's just to say, like, you know, this is a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a chess match here, which is, you know, yeah, Paxson might, you know, mobilize some disillusioned Republicans a little bit better in some sense, because in a real sense, I mean, look.
Potentially disillusioned Republicans.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Right? I mean, in a real sense, look, Paxson has maintained his position in, you know, I would say the vanguard of the Republican base in some ways, like in a way that Cornyn has not.
Right. They call themselves the grassroots.
Right. And Paxson has, the word that I use, I say this over again, people have heard him, it's like he has assiduously courted this group over the course of his political career. Yeah. And even with, you know, the impact that sort of Trumpism as an ideology on the Republican Party has to make this a little bit muddy, to go back to our other thing, think about foreign policy, all this other stuff. In some ways, Paxson's a pretty safe bet if you're looking for more of the same stuff that Republicans have been delivering over the last decade, right?
Which is, yeah, I mean, ultimately, the, you know, what we used to call the Tea Party fusion now mutated into what we call the MAGA.
Well, I've been thinking lately, and we're talking about this, we'll come back to this, but this notion of, you know, anti-incumbency or anti-incumbency plus, and one of the dividing lines I put on a lot of it is, you know, well, were you elected before the Tea Party wave or not? And it's not that that's a guarantee, but like when you think about the people who have retired, who've been primaried, who are retiring, a lot of those, mostly guys, some gals, came in that way before that Tea Party, you know, adjustment. That's not, I mean, Paxton was riding that wave in some sense, you know, I mean, he's definitely been a fan. And so.
And he, yeah, and he was part of it, is it?
But I mean, I think the whole piece of this, again, speaking past the whole elite thing, is that, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Paxton may, at a moment in time when Republicans might be a little bit unsure about exactly what the party means, especially if the leader at the top is kind of, you know, doing what he's doing. In some ways, Paxton can say, yeah, but look at what I've done. Look at what I've done for you. I've got the record to hit you on these things. Yeah. And that should be a salve for some Republicans who are a little unsure about the direction of the party.
You know, when you set it up that way, it helps me work it into the way I've been thinking about this, which is in some ways, Paxton, narrowly speaking, is a better vehicle for getting the benefits from the state at the state level of Trumpism without the drag from Trump.
Right. But,
and Trumpism is the wrong, I shouldn't use that word, but
yeah,
that current, but you tap into that without being entirely dependent on Trump himself, who is a figure right now is, and again, we'll talk about this later. Yeah. I mean, look, we don't want to overplay that. Trump is still at 81, 82% favorability rating or job approval rating or
among Republicans.
Among Republicans.
Right.
So it's not a huge problem among Republicans.
Right. But the issue is going to be in some ways, you know, can he, again, to your point,
but does he countermobilize?
Yeah. What's his countermobilizing potential? But I would just say, look, real quick, that's a terrible argument. I mean, if you're in politics right now and your argument, you know, if you're a junker, I'm not saying I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth, but if the argument sounds something like, well, you know, Democrats and independents are really going to turn out to vote against my opponent if you elect him, people are going to say, yeah, well, go to, I mean, they're going to say something to you and it's not going to be nice, which is like, yeah, what does that have to do with me? What does that have to do with our party? What does that have to do with, you know, picking, you know, that's just not a good.
And there's just not much evidence that.
Well, and the evidence that we have
Cornyn
is so minimal.
Somehow that, and you're looking at mobilization and counter mobilization.
Yeah.
As affecting your vote count, just to be
right.
You know,
yeah.
Brass tacks about it. You know, your vote count from Democrats and independents that you might get, which the gains you might get in your vote count from nominating Cornyn, this data suggests are likely to be, broadly speaking, offset by what you lose on the other end.
Yeah.
On the mobilization.
Or you know, at the very least, it's muddy.
Right.
It's not clear.
And it's not clear in the way that the initial premise of the Cornyn candidacy suggested.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I think that was all useful. So I think what we'll do is, we say this a lot and we don't always follow through, but on this one, semester's almost over.
Yeah.
You know, we got a little space here. We'll try to package some of this data that's not on the website right now and put it in a blog post. You know, I don't want to make any promises. We'll try to have it done before the next podcast. How's that?
I think that's a good idea.
I think we can do that. And so that you can all look at this, because I think it really does provide a lot of nuance and it really does help clarify. Again, the data are limited. It's April.
Yeah.
But it does clarify, as I'm thinking about it now, this, what is the balance between mobilization and counter-mobilization that we can begin to think about in a little bit more data-driven terms in thinking about the general election.
Yeah, and one thing I just want to add here before we wrap up, because it's important, and I know there are people who listen to this who might say, wait a minute, you got Tallarico up on Paxton and Cornyn. This is nuts. But I do want to point out the other trial ballots, which we'll get to next week, the generic trial ballot for U.S. Congress, for the tech sledge. The Republican led the Democrat in both of those. The generic Republican beat the generic Democrat. Abbott was up over Hinojosa in his race. Patrick was up over who we expect to be the nominee, Goodwin.
Yeah, Goodwin.
And so this is just to say, oh, and the overall sample leans Republican as we would expect in
by
the state,
10 points.
By 10 points. And so this is all just to point out that, you know, just to say these results in of themselves can't be discounted out of hand without saying that those results are also not right. So just as a reminder, you know, this, everything looks pretty good, but this is a specific thing, which is why we want to dig into it so much.
I will say that to our kudos to a lot of the press coverage, at least that I saw, and yeah. I haven't read all the clips yet. On one hand, we always wish they'd go a little bit deeper. I wish people had flagged the limits on the support for, you know, the support for Cornyn and Paxton in those seats. Generally, I was pretty happy that while nobody could resist that, very few people could resist the headline, Tallarico leads Republicans. A lot of the coverage did point out
that pieces of it.
This was the only race where we saw a Democrat clearly leading a Republican, and it's obviously this thing is not like the others.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And we'll come back to this next week when we talk about the general environment and a little bit more and what this tells us about the election environment. Fair to say that the Abbott and Patrick leads were not as comfortable as people might expect.
Yeah.
But that's also something that we've seen in polling this far out at the top of the ballot. It has to do with the difference between the sample and the expected election turnout.
Yeah, you know,
at least historically.
Well, there's a little trick that, you know, our colleague Darren will always do is say, well, you know, recalculate. Take out all the people who don't have an opinion and then recalculate the percentages. And you know what happens? That lead grows.
Yeah. And it looks
a little bit more normal.
Looks a little bit more like what you would expect.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So Darren, you were here in spirit. So with that, Josh, thanks for the work on doing the extra groundwork to get this ready.
It's interesting.
It was fruitful. Thanks again to our excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, ever stalwart and helpful and producing a great sounding product for us without making them responsible for the actual content.
Right.
And of course, thanks to you for listening. Again, supporting data, all the stuff we talked about today, much, much more from the April UT Texas Politics Project poll. Check it out at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And remember, if you're going to share some of these results with students, clients, friends, cocktail parties, when you look at the particular graphics, there's these three horizontal bars up in the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah.
If you click on that, it will bring down multiple file formats that you can download those graphics for free. Drop them in your PowerPoints, take them to your tattoo artist, whatever.
Nice.
But they're there. They're free. It's not always as clear as we'd like that you can do that, but really urge you to grab them and use them for, again, presentations, teaching, social media, whatever. So with that, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.